Make my lips. My lips are damp.
I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Health Care and Health Policy and Veterans Affairs to order. Do you want to open to?
Sure. I'll call the House Committee on Health Care out of recess into order.
I get the first 15 minutes, and it's now down to 12 minutes.
No, you take 15.
I can take 15. All right. I'd like to welcome Senator Johnson. Nice to have you here. I want everyone to know that, as you know, the process sometimes gets a little chaotic, and we are not ready to move out 451, 452, and 457 today. But the reason we were wanting to have the work session today is because this will be the one chance for the House members to hear these cost-containment bills. And so I would like to call Dr. Janine Smith and Reese Sailors up to the front to just overview for the House 451, which I think you've already heard, so we probably don't need to spend much time on that. That's the Pulse. Then 452 and 457, so that you know that these bills are moving, but we need to get some more amendments on 452. And so, Dr. Smith?
Chairman Sanderson, Chair Greenlee, and members of two committees. I'm Janine Smith, the Administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research, and we help to staff the Oregon Health Fund Board effort. And these bills, all three of them, are a product of that. Senate Bill 451 is the Pulse Registry, which members of the House Committee already did have testimony on, which is the Physician-Ordered Life-Sustaining Treatment Registry. And this is important effort to try to coordinate care at the end of life, and it is a matter of just getting some words clarified in its amendment, and I won't go over any further on that one. Reed, do you want to do 452?
Yes, good afternoon. I'm Reeve Sailors with the Governor's Office, Chair Mona Sanderson, Chair Greenlee, members of the both committees. Senate Bill 452 relates to health information technology. This, as Dr. Smith has alluded, is also an outgrowth of recommendations by the Health Fund Board and the Health Information Infrastructure Advisory Committee that was constituted by an executive order of the Governor just about a year ago. The provisions in Senate Bill 452 are designed to put us in a good position to be able to take advantage of the federal stimulus dollars that are available for HIT adoption, and to create the HIT Oversight Council, which will be responsible for developing a statewide plan for HIT and also monitoring our progress as we implement and adopt and deploy electronic health records and develop health information exchange, or otherwise known as interoperability. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Well, okay. thank you, Madam Chair. It's a very good bill if we're doing it right. And so we aren't stepping on the feet of those local organizations that are already developing good systems. But clearly for a lot of it, because, Madam Chair, this does fit into your telemedicine very well as well. And we have capacity issues in the state that clearly need to be addressed.
Representative Greenlee?
I was just curious if we'd seen any sense of a fiscal on that bill yet.
I think they are reworking that. We're waiting on some dash 3 amendments, which will have some minor effects on the fiscal note. The essence of the amendments would be to change, actually what we've done is remove the compensation for the members so that it's only travel. And then the original bill called for at least monthly meetings and others as needed. We've changed that language to at least quarterly. And others as needed. And then the final piece is language that's got into the dash 2 amendments, which would have interfered with our ability to bring down federal match. So we're having that removed. Does that answer you?
Thank you.
So we don't have the fiscal yet. And there will be a fiscal, but the we need to take advantage of this federal stimulus dollars, which will help the state immensely.
And the I might add that the fiscal, the dollars that are attached to this are also available for in-kind match to the federal funds and will be needed for us to pull down some of those planning and implementation grants that are available under the Stimulus Act.
And all three of these bills will be going to Ways and Means. All right.
From Senate Bill 457 is the Healthcare Workforce Initiative data collection, and it was one of the next best steps towards system transformation by allowing us to better understand the healthcare workforce shortages. It will implement a data collection program using the health professions licensing process and provide routine data analysis so Oregon has ongoing capacity to understand Oregon's healthcare workforce, inform public and private educational and workforce investments, and inform policy recommendations for state health planning. This was developed in collaboration with a lot of the work done by Senator Morris in his interim committee with the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Initiative, and also some of the concepts were discussed in some work that Dr. John Moorhead and I did with the Oregon Medical Association with Senator Wyden, with the idea that we need, if we're, where would we best put our next dollars, and we don't really have really great data on where our workforce is. And we've tried to do surveys on an ongoing basis, but they're delayed, both on the data we get from the national level and also what we are able to do just surveying, and which are expensive as well. And so it was really, there's also potentially some federal investment dollars coming in, and the Employment Division came and gave testimony to the Senate Committee about how vital this information would be to them to know where to target their federal dollars that they often have access to. It was included in the governor's recommended budget. It's fiscal, it would require a state investment around $470,000, and it would be in close collaboration with the Healthcare Workforce Institute to work, which has already started work over this last year, trying to sort this through on how to make the lowest possible impact on the licensing boards. So those like the nursing board, which are very far progressed and actually get great data, wouldn't have, you know, what theirs would be fairly easy to aggregate. Those who maybe are still doing paper, we could do simple things like SurveyMonkey and other tools that would not cost a great deal to the boards to be able to get this data to us.
And another thing, colleagues, just so that you know, the amount of money that the feds will have for this type of project, there are grants up to $750 million, I believe it was $750 million, that we would be eligible to apply for. And that's, I feel, another reason why we would need to get this bill down to Ways and Means. Okay?
Let's just take the whole $750 million and...
That'd be nice. Okay. All right. Well, that's all we have. We did want you, the House, to know what we were doing in the Senate, since, you know, the process is such that you may not actually have a public hearing on these bills, and they'll go straight to the floor or go through full Ways and Means and then go to the floor for you to vote. So with that, I'd like to close, unless there's any other questions, I'd like to close the work session on 451, 452, and before I close them, I just want to say we will be carrying these bills over till tomorrow and see if we have the amendments. If we don't, we'll just keep carrying them over until we have the amendments. All right, with that, I'll close Bill 51, 452, and 457. Thank you, Representative.
And I'm open a work session on HB 2009, and that leads me to raise the question. We do need to get some guidance on whether, once you get them to Ways and Means, we want to amend them into 2009, and whether we want to treat them as a separate package, and we can have that discussion. We're hoping to perfect 2009 by April 15th or so, so it will be, you know, easy to make that have that discussion as soon as we can. Thank you.
That's good.
We're in this work session in 2009. Our intention is to limit discussion to one component of a fiscal mechanism. We're considering using as a part of the revenue to match with $1 billion of federal money to expand the Oregon Health Plan by 80,000 kids or so and up to 100,000 adults. There, in the governor's proposal, and we'll hear just a little bit about that, there was a hospital tax proposed and a health insurance premium tax proposed. And an alternative proposal came to the committees in the form of a proposal that would include a hospital tax and a tax on claims being processed for health care. What we're asking the proponents on both sides of this question tonight is to deal specifically with the question of the insurance tax versus the claims tax, the insurance premium tax versus a claim tax. And we've asked Dr. Goldberg to start the discussion by comparing them and talking about what difference it makes in terms of finances. And then we'll ask some folks from the proponents of each of the alternatives to come and talk to us about that. We have a couple of panels scheduled for those two groups. We think by that point we may get to, may take us in the neighborhood of an hour. And in the second hour, we'll be inviting folks up who've asked to testify to give a 3-minute maximum testimony to up, and we'll try and call them in panels that represent positions on each of the alternatives in some firm and equitable way. So, Dr. Goldberg, did you all decide you're going to be alone? You're going to be together? What's your...
I can't be alone. It requires two people to be honest.
Chair Greenlich, Chair Moniz Anderson, members of the committees, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, the Director of the Department of Human Services. Chair Greenlich, Chair Moniz Anderson, for the record, Kerry Barnett. I'm here representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, as well as a coalition of healthcare organizations that include Pacific Source, Kaiser, Providence, Legacy, OAHHS, and of course Regents as well.
And I'm Tim Nesbitt, I'm Deputy Chief of Staff of the Governor and representing him tonight.
And with that, what I thought I would do is hopefully as succinctly and understandably as possible sort of lay the groundwork for the committee to really understand these two proposals. As you know, Chair Greenlich had indicated, this is really about looking at two different ways of taxing healthcare benefits, a premium tax and a claims tax. But we really need to back up a little bit and talk about the fact that we as a state have had provider taxes, these are in the realm of provider taxes, for about the last 5 years. And we've used provider taxes to leverage federal matching dollars.
Thank you.
To continue funding on the Oregon Health Plan. That's currently how we fund the 24,000 individuals that are on the Oregon Health Plan standard. So currently, the provider tax revenues, a small amount of client premium, and the federal match are the sole source of funding for Oregon Health Plan standard. We call them provider taxes, but they're really not provider taxes. We have two taxes right now. One is a tax on Medicaid managed care organizations, and another is a tax on hospitals. These are what we call provider taxes. We're here tonight not to speak about the hospital tax, but to speak about the other taxes. The current taxes were legislatively authorized in 2003. They were reauthorized in 2007. And the reason we're here tonight, amongst others, is because these taxes expire 9/30/09. So without any action during this legislature, one way or another, these taxes will expire. The current managed care tax is a tax solely on organizations that provide managed care services within the Oregon Health Plan. So these are solely around the Medicaid managed care organizations. And that is a tax that is 5.5% of the health plan's capitation or the premium that they receive from the state. Likewise, there's a current hospital tax of 0.63% of net hospital revenues. The reason we do these as a state is that each of those tax dollars leverages federal dollars. And our federal match rate was, up until about a month ago, for every dollar that the state put into the health plan, we were able to leverage approximately $1.68. Due to the federal stimulus package, the state's match rate has been enhanced quite substantially. And now every dollar is able to leverage approximately $2.64 in the Medicaid program. So it's a pretty steep increase.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, no, thank you. Bruce, for how long do we have that increase?
Chairman Anderson, Senator Cruz, the federal stimulus package increased the match rate retroactive back to October 1, 2008,
right,
and continues through December 31st, 2010. So that enhanced match rate will expire January 1, 2011, with 6 months left to go in the current biennium. One of the reasons we're here tonight is that the federal rules will no longer allow the state to continue its current Medicaid managed care tax. The federal government has changed its administrative rules such that it no longer allows a tax solely on Medicaid managed care organizations. In order to have any kind of a tax on insurance entities, it needs to be broad-based and needs to be based beyond simply Medicaid managed care. So for tonight's discussion, what we're really talking about is the need for the state to move beyond the Medicaid managed care model, and two proposals to broaden that. One is a proposal to broaden it on healthcare premiums, and another is to broaden it on the processing of claims within health insurance. So to understand that, and I'm on page 6 of the handout, I think first and foremost it's really important to understand Oregon's health care coverage and the, so to speak, the marketplace. Currently, we care for about 428, this was 2007 data, the caseloads are up now, but for discussion purposes, in 2007, on the Oregon Health Plan and Medicaid, we provided services for about 428,000 individuals. 80% of that was cared for by our Medicaid managed care organizations. We have about 547,000 individuals on Medicare. The commercial insurance market, which I'm going to break down for you, has a little over 2 million individuals. And I think it's important to understand the commercial insurance market to understand the two proposals. And then lastly, the uninsured comprise, unfortunately all too large of a segment of our state population, 576,000. So if you go to the next page, this really sets, I think, the stage for this evening's discussion. So if you look at the commercial insurance market, generally things can be divided into two general ways that businesses or individuals provide health care coverage for themselves. most businesses, as you can see, a little over 1.3 million individuals in businesses are covered in the what's called the large and the small group insurance market. That means that those businesses buy health insurance coverage from insurers in the state to cover their workers. There are about 235,000 individuals in the state who likewise buy for themselves health insurance coverage from a health insurer. They go to Regents and or another health insurer. I'm trying to be fair tonight, so no advertising. But they'll purchase health insurance from a health insurance carrier, pay the premiums themselves out of pocket, as opposed to their employer. And that's about 235,000 individuals. The next line is what's called self-insured. And these are businesses who generally choose to, rather than purchasing traditional insurance from a carrier, will self-insure themselves for that risk. They'll pay out their claims. They do that, however, through the use oftentimes of what's called third-party administrators. And what third-party administrators will do, or other benefits managers, are a couple of things. They will often bring a network of providers to a business, as well as they will pay those healthcare claims for the business. But again, the business itself is insuring itself. They're taking the risk for that. They're not purchasing risk from the carrier. They're really purchasing what are a set of administrative services. And then the last piece, and then this is a very small piece of the current commercial health insurance market, is the high-risk pool, OMIP, and those individuals who buy portability coverage. And as you can see, that's a negligible portion of what is over 2 million individuals in the state. So that really sets the stage for you to understand the two different proposals. The first proposal is a premium tax. And what that is a proposal to tax the
Senator value. Bates.
I just want to ask a quick question just for clarity, and maybe for people who aren't as familiar as some of us are. In the self-insured population, can you give us some examples of who those are, and could you also give us an example of who the third-party administrators are?
Sure. Chairs, Mona Sanderson Greenlick, Senator Bates. Generally, these are large employers because to be able to assume the risk for insurance, generally you need to have a certain size. So the 611,000 individuals who are self-insured through their businesses tend to work for large employers. I believe that in Oregon, amongst them are Intel, Nike, large corporations. In terms of the organizations that manage that are the third-party administrators, they are a variety, and I'll actually defer to Kerry for some help, but certainly Regents is both, and several of the insurance companies, Regents, I believe actually ODS as well, and some others, are both insurers. They offer a traditional insurance product. They also function as third-party administrators, and they administer the benefit for some of those large employers. There's also some third-party administrators who are not themselves large insurers.
That's correct. That's correct.
So some are quite large in that they have large books of business.
You better identify yourself.
I'm sorry. Terry Barnett again, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Some of the TPAs, standalone TPAs, can be quite large, often operating across state lines. And then some are quite small and operate really for only one group or a small number of groups. But by and large, the greatest bulk of the TPA business in many ways is handled by licensed insurers who are writing business essentially on the side that is what we call ASO, administrative services only. And I think it's probably safe to say that Regions is probably the largest TPA in the sense that we probably have the largest ASO book of business.
Isn't it correct, though, that it isn't just big corporations? I know that Clackamas County is self-insured. Portland School District is self-insured.
Chairman Sanderson, correct. Oftentimes there are union trusts that self-insure themselves for risk, as well as, I guess, in Oregon, I would consider some of those organizations large employers. But, you know, it's not just large companies. This can be governmental entities, union trusts. You know, generally, it's more than, 100 or 200 individuals
Bruce,
who
excuse me
do that.
Could we ask whoever has got their devices turned on that's interfering with the recording here to please turn them off? Be very helpful. I'm sorry, Bruce. Go ahead.
Certainly. So the premium tax, you know, proposes a 1.5% tax. This is actually on the gross amount of premium that licensed insurers charge. So it's a 1% tax. It would be on those fully insured, as well as on the Medicaid managed care organizations. So if you go, you know, back to those two previous slides, a piece of that would be on those organizations who currently are taxed, the Medicaid managed care organizations, and the remainder would be through the taxing the insurers on the value of the premium, which is in essence for the approximately 1.5 million lives, the 1.3 in the large and small group market and the 235,000 individuals who purchase that insurance themselves. The claims tax proposes a very different mechanism. It's a 1% tax on the value of processing the medical and dental claims by both fully insured, self-insured, Medicaid managed care, and the proposal has been also Medicare Advantage, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But in essence, what this does is taxes the processing of the claim and bases that tax on the aggregate value of those claims. And what that does is then it taxes the 1.3 million in the large and small group market, the 235,000 in the individual market. And in essence, what this tax does is also spread that to the self-insured, because it now is taxing the processing of the claim, not simply the value of the premium, because again, those who self-insure aren't paying a premium, they're just paying for a service of processing the claim, and insurers process claims also. So it would tax both the insurance companies as well as the third-party administrators at 1% tax on the value of the processing of those claims.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Medicaid fee-for-service is not included then.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, that's correct. It's not included now and wouldn't be under this proposal. either of these proposals. The reason for both of these, again, is that the federal government no longer allows the state to solely and preferentially tax Medicaid organizations. And the reason behind that is that oftentimes these taxes are used, as the state does, to leverage federal dollars to go into the Medicaid program. So the federal government is seeking to make these taxes broader. And they have really three criteria. They want it to be broad-based, so across a, a, class of either of health insurance. They'd like it to be uniform. You can't tax one entity one rate and another entity another rate. And then the last piece is no one can be held harmless through these. So those are the criteria that the federal government looks at in terms of matching the expenditures from this. If you turn to the last page, and it really is a little bit of a grid that, again, I think does two things. It reiterates who's taxed. So on the premium side, it's the gross amount of premium for all health insurers, managed care organizations, Medicaid managed care organizations, commercial preferred provider plans, etc. And for the claims tax, it's the processing of those claims from insurers, indemnity plans, limited benefit plans, third-party administrators. What this shows you is, and what I wanted to spend a moment on, is the revenue raise. The premium tax at 1.5% raises approximately $169 million over a 21-month period. And the claims tax raises approximately $174 million over a 24-month period. The numbers around each of these are estimates, and I think those numbers are fairly close. What I would indicate, and I think is important to understand, and I'm sure will come up later in the evening, is that the initial proposal around the claims tax included Medicare Advantage plans. These are health plans that provide a health insurance benefit to Medicare beneficiaries. I've removed the amounts that the tax would garner and from that figure, and that's because we've been working through with, I think, rather collaboratively over the last couple of weeks, attorneys from Ledge Counsel, attorneys from the Department of Justice, as well as some attorneys that have come from the regions and the group that Carrie had mentioned that brought this proposal forward. We've been trying to work through a number of the legal questions regarding these taxes. And so I'm going to end my presentation hopefully walking through some of those as accurately and as unbiased as I can, understanding that I'm not a lawyer, but I've sat in the discussions with all of them for the last couple of weeks. And I would say this, that, you know, initially, there's been three questions that have been looked at. The first two have been legal questions, and the third has been a question of the ability to use any of the funds garnered from these two different mechanisms and have the federal government match them. So let me cover each of those. In terms of the matchability issue, as we call it, would the federal government approve revenue that the state raised under either of these two mechanisms and provide that $1.66, $2.64 in federal match? You know, we believe that the premium tax is currently considered by the federal government very under its current provider tax laws. They have rules to have states broaden that, and we believe that the premium tax would be approved. They've done that before. On the claims tax, this is actually a new entity for the federal government. They've never made considered the matchability of this. Having said that, we have reason to believe that this meets the three tests of the federal government, that it's broad-based, spread across all these different groups, it's uniform, everybody gets the 1% tax, and no one is held harmless by this. And we believe that the federal government would approve that. We would have to get some assurance from them that they would. That process would take, you know, we hope somewhere between 30 and 60 days to get a read from the federal government that they would indeed approve the matching of the claims tax. There are then two legal issues. And one of them is ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. And rather than getting into a discussion of what ERISA is and how it would affect these, because quite frankly, I'm not the best at being able to explain all of that. What I'd like to do is just summarize what the large number of attorneys we've been working with have come to the conclusion of. And I think that there's general agreement amongst the attorneys that have looked at this from all sides that it is very likely the way that the claims tax has been structured as being a tax on the processing of claims, that it would withstand an ERISA challenge if it were challenged. Now, I can't speak to, nor can anyone speak to, whether or not that would be challenged and what would happen in terms of if it were challenged in court.
So, excuse me, do you have a written opinion or anything like that on this? Because there are other written opinions being circulated that say the opposite, and I guess I'm wondering, are we at that point? What evidence do you have to verify this perspective?
You know, Chair Monis Anderson, Chair Greenlick, Representative Kennemer, you know, I believe if Kerry would like to, he has some written opinions. Ledge Counsel has not provided a written opinion at this point, nor am I in a position to share the Department of Justice's opinion about that at this point. But
have you reviewed Lane Powell's opinion? Written opinion that's been submitted.
I have, but again, I'm again not a lawyer and can't comment on the validity of that, but really can tell you the results of the discussions that have gone on.
Before we switch, just for the record, I could ask this two ways, but the reason that we are going forth with a tax, in your mind, how do you see what that money will be used for?
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, the purpose of these taxes has been to expand coverage and enrollment in the Oregon Health Plan. So to cover an additional number of children as well as adults in the Oregon Health Plan Standard Program.
I think Mr. Nesbitt's going to talk about that as well. Is that right?
But it's probably something I should have mentioned at the outset, so I appreciate the reminder.
Madam Chair, quick question. Dr. Goldberg, thank you. Can you just, going back just for a sec, to start this 30 or 60-day ticker, if you will, with the federal government, what is an application process? Do they need to see movement of legislation? What actually starts the process?
Chairs Greenlick and Monis Anderson, Representative Bruin. The way the process would work is we would bring a proposal to the federal government, to the CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. We work with a consulting law firm in D.C., and we've been talking with them about this. They feel that the case would best be made if they actually brought some legislation forward, proposed legislation, because in the CMS's mind, that really helps to define exactly what it is they're talking about. So a piece of proposed legislation, and our consultant would bring that to CMS and would informally sit down. This is how we often do a number of things, would sit down with them and walk them through the proposal, indicate that, you know, we were under the impression that this would be amenable to federal match, and then would ask them to provide us with a letter indicating that they had reviewed this and that they saw this as fitting within the what they call the provider tax regulations. With that letter in hand, we would feel pretty secure that they then would provide the matching funds, and we've been told that can take anywhere from 30 to 60 days.
Representative, why don't you follow up, and then let's let Mr. Nesbitt, Mr. Burnett.
Okay, and it's a real quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair. The question is, do you just need a bill to do that, or do you have to have movement on a bill? I mean, would a drafted legislation be enough to get the ball rolling?
Chairs and Representative Bruin, my understanding is a draft will suffice. I think what the federal government's really looking for is some sense of clarity about what it is that they're ruling on, and so the letter would indicate something. If this legislation were passed, then you know, they would look favorably on a proposal like that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are you done?
There is one last
legal.
I'm trying to remember the second the ERISA issue, the match issue, and just let me cover the Medicare issue. Very briefly, this is one place where there hasn't been a consensus amongst all of the folks that have been discussing this in earnest over the last couple of weeks, which has been the ability to tax Medicare Advantage plans and to withstand any kind of challenge of that. You know, quite frankly, we believe that it wouldn't be wise to go forward with that tax. I know that there's a differing opinion, and hence that's why we've priced this without the Medicare Advantage. If this were to go forward and that were to be added, that would be, in addition, really tried to portray some conservative numbers. So with that, what I've tried to do is lay this out as ecumenically as possible, and I'll let the two gentlemen on my right decide on and left decide on whether I've done that.
Yeah, two thumbs up. Who's going first?
Again, Kerry Barnett, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Chairs Greenlich and Mona Sanderson. I think Bruce did a great job of laying it out. And I have some other remarks that I'll make that I'll, if you don't mind, that I'll save until the panel comes up. If I could just make a couple of comments. I think there's clarity around what is the essential difference between the claims assessment that we put forward versus the governor's premium tax approach. And I think Bruce did a great job of laying it out. The biggest difference is the claims assessment is, we believe, more broad-based and more equitable in that it affects everybody in that... on page 7 of Bruce's slide deck, it affects everybody equally. It brings in the 611,000 people, and by broadening the impact of the tax, it allows for the amount of the tax on any one individual to be smaller. And that's, we believe, very important for the sustainability of this as a tax. I know we'll hear from Tim, and you're going to probably hear from a lot of different people this evening. The reality is that there's a whole lot more, I think, that Tim and I and many of the people who you're going to hear from agree upon in terms of what we're trying to accomplish here. What we're trying to accomplish is to bring more people into the system, because we've got a big problem in Oregon with too many people who are uninsured. And that's a moral problem. It's an efficiency problem. It's an ethical problem. It's a cost shift problem, and on and on and on. And what we're trying to do is come up with a way that we can generate funds in order to take advantage of a great match from CMS and put together a program that will bring more kids into the system and more low-income adults. And that's really what we're trying to do here. The question that you're faced with is how to structure that tax. Where are those dollars going to come from? The key differentiator, as I've said, is this notion of how broad-based the tax should be. I'll talk more about that when the panel comes up. There is, unfortunately, this overlay of a legal issue over this. And I just want to speak to that just for a moment. And in reference to Representative Kinnemer's question, we would love to see the opinion from Lane Powell. And if useful, create a dialogue with the attorneys that we've been using out of Washington, D.C. The attorneys that we've been using are specialists in ERISA, who frankly spend most of their time being hired by large companies to challenge statutes for being violative of ERISA and therefore preempted under ERISA. So it was very helpful for us to be working with this particular law firm to help design an assessment that would not be preempted under ERISA. This stuff gets pretty arcane pretty quickly, as you can imagine. There are different circuit court opinions out there. As a matter of fact, the Ninth Circuit, where we are, is one of the strongest circuits for upholding an assessment of the type that we've laid out here. We're pretty confident, based on the legal advice that we've been given, that this will pass legal muster. And based on that, we created a series of dialogues with folks from the Attorney General's office and staff from DHS that Bruce referred to. And I think that when they had an opportunity to clarify exactly what this proposal was and what it wasn't, and to pick through the nuances of ERISA, it was determined that this is a very strong case that this would not be preempted. Sometimes there's a tendency to throw out opinions about ERISA without fully understanding exactly what the nuances were of this particular proposal, and it's important that we don't do that as well. But we would be happy to create more dialogue to begin to go through those layers of the legal issues to, I think, provide some comfort that this is something that would pass legal muster.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Just to clarify, the Lane Powell opinion that Representative Kinnemer referenced was one that we heard with respect to OMIP. I don't think they've given an opinion yet on the TPA issue.
And it was a particular kind of proposal in taxing OMIP.
Well, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for clarifying.
I appreciate that clarification because that's exactly my point. This proposal was put together very carefully. It's not a tax, it's an assessment. It's not on claims, it's on the third-party processing of claims. And all of that is very important in making sure that this is not preempted by ERISA. So that's a very important clarification. It's very important that we're talking about exactly this.
Are you saying if a purchaser processed their own claims, then it wouldn't be third-party?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Let's go on. Tim, do you want to? Are you done with this phase?
I'm happy to respond to any questions that people may have in terms of clarifying the proposal, but other than that, I'll wait for the panel.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, Deputy Chief of Staff for the Governor. And I'm here to explain the governor's proposal for restructuring the managed care portion of the existing provider tax, which is also being called and is called in current state law a provider assessment, or rather an assessment. I shouldn't use the word provider. I've provided written testimony. I'm not going to read it, but at certain points I'm going to slow down and I may just read some of these points because I'm trying to make sure you're clear about how our proposal will work and the questions that have arisen and we're trying to sharpen from the proposed claims tax or claims assessment. As you can see, we're skeptical of the proposal for a claims assessment, but we also appreciate that it's a creative response to our proposal, and we think it deserves careful scrutiny and comparison to our proposal. And as Dr. Goldberg pointed out in that last chart he gave you, It's important to note that these two proposals, both our proposal for a premium assessment and the insurer's proposal for a claims assessment, would raise similar amounts of revenue, $169 million under our proposal and $174 million under the insurer's proposal. If this were a pure negotiations over money, we could split that 1% difference and be done. But it's not that simple, for the reasons you've already started to hear. I think it's important, again, Carrie said as much, that what is on the table in both proposals is enough new state revenue which, if fully funded with federal funds, fully matched with federal funds, could finance affordable health care for all children in Oregon and have funds left over to rebuild the Oregon Health Plan. And in the end, that's the bottom line that we think should matter most.
My pen ran out, too.
To talk about why we brought this proposal to you, as Dr. Goldberg already explained, there's an element of legal necessity. We have to restructure and renew this managed care assessment in order to continue to qualify for federal matching funds. There's also the motivation of the need, the social need, motivated by the creation of the Oregon Health Plan 2 decades ago. We've gotten the waivers for federal matching funds for that fully expanded Oregon Health Plan, but we've never been able to get there. In fact, that's the third point, the financial opportunity. We're leaving more than $1 billion every biennium on the table in Washington, D.C., in federal funds already approved in waivers for the Oregon Health Plan and children's coverage. Let me slow down a bit here on point five in my handout. So in order to continue the assessment of Medicaid MCOs and do so in a way that continues to qualify for federal matching funds, we have to come up with a tax that is broad-based. And that means, at a minimum, following the guidance from CMS, we have to extend this assessment to all managed care plans. It turns out that the category of, quote, all managed care plans, unquote, is quite broad. It includes all commercial plans, since all such plans have networks of providers which meet the definition of managed care. As spelled out in House Bill 2116 and in Section 130 of House Bill 2009, that category then of all managed care plans is insurers, defined in both bills, who charge premiums for health benefit plans, as defined under current law, ORS 743.730. The assessment proposed in these bills applies to premiums paid to insurers and to payments paid to Medicaid MCOs. By doing so, it clearly complies with the new federal requirement for a broad-based tax, no doubt about it. We looked at whether to apply this assessment more broadly when we were constructing the proposal. We looked at whether to apply it to third-party administrators, TPAs, who administer health benefit plans established by self-insured employers, but we chose not to for several reasons. First, TPAs do not collect premiums as insurers do. We would have had to capture a different revenue stream with a different kind of assessment to bring them in. This was not a disqualifier, but it was a complicating factor. Second, private employers who are self-insured are covered by ERISA, which creates legal barriers to any tax or assessment on their health benefit plans. You've already heard about that issue. And third, we're not aware of any state where an assessment on revenues that support a health benefit plan for self-insured employers had been approved by CMS as a source of revenue eligible for Medicaid matching funds. And we are still not aware of any such precedent. So because of the legal vulnerabilities and uncertainties, we chose a more certain path to restructuring the current Medicaid MCO assessment. Think of that path as the Goldilocks option. Not so narrow that it will be rejected by the feds, and not so broad that it will invite legal challenges and or require new determinations by the feds to qualify for matching funds. Our approach is just broad enough to meet the CMS definition of broad-based and not too broad to create legal vulnerabilities and uncertainties. And we believe this is the best and safest approach, because we're basically constructing a successor assessment to the current MCO assessment. It is as close to the structure of the current assessment as possible. We have good data on the revenue bases involved. We have confidence that it can be quickly and efficiently put in place and administered because it builds on the current structure. In sum, it's the option with the greatest feasibility, practicality, and certainty. Now, about rates. We currently assess the capitated payments that the Medicaid managed care plans receive from the state at a rate of 5.5%. Under the governor's budget, we recommended the rate be reduced to 1.5%, applied to both the capitated payments received by Medicaid MCOs, as currently done, and to the health plan premiums collected by insurers. Now, you can't find this 1.5% rate in either of the bills I mentioned because it wasn't included in the legislation. It was considered a working draft number in the governor's recommended budget. But it wasn't a guess either. First, we wanted to collect at least the same amount of revenue that we're collecting now from the Medicaid MCO assessment, which amounts to about $133 million a biennium. Second, we wanted a revenue stream sufficient to fully fund a fully enrolled plan to children's coverage. We define full enrollment as the additional number we can enroll to get the coverage for 95% of all children in Oregon below the age of 19. That goal computes to a coverage for an additional 80,000 children by the end of this coming biennium, 09-11. The additional children would be covered, the largest number of them, 60,000, who are below 200% of the federal poverty level, through SCHIP and the Oregon Health Plan. The smaller number, about 20,000, between 200 and 300% of federal poverty level, to whom we would offer subsidized coverage under FEOP and state-sponsored private insurance plans. So it turned out that the rate needed to accomplish these goals was somewhere between 1 and 1.5% in the structure we developed. So we chose 1.5% as the working draft number. Is there room there to modify? Of course there is. And of course that's what you're working with right now. Now, since we constructed the governor's proposal, there have been several new developments. Most significantly, Congress passed the new SCHIP, which provides more slots for children's coverage at the richer match of $2.83 in federal funds for each state dollar. And that's separate from the additional monies, what I call the signing bonus, that we'll get under the stimulus package if we, in fact, enroll more people in the current, in between now and December of 2010. That SCHIP capacity, expanded SCHIP capacity, will reduce the cost of covering those 80,000 children by about 20%. The same federal legislation gives states until 2011 to make use of their CHIP capacity. Our capacity lines up nicely, our capacity, the slots we have under the new federal legislation, lines up nicely with our timeline for covering 80,000 additional children. We plan to do so by the end of 09-11. But if we don't make use of our new CHIP capacity by then, we will lose the money. This is not just a matter of leaving money on the table. This has become a use-it-or-lose-it proposition when it comes to covering children. Oregon's unused CHIP funds will be distributed to other states if we don't use them. And finally, since we developed our proposal, we've been presented with the insurer's proposal for a 1% claims tax or assessment. And let me share with you our concerns about that proposal. I think first it's important to distinguish between premiums and claims as we know them under Oregon law and under current practices. Premiums are comprised of the portion of medical costs that are paid by insurers, not by individuals directly, plus the cost of administration and reserves. Thus, copays and deductibles paid by individuals are not part of premiums. Claims include the cost of medical care that is billed through third-party payers, whether insurance companies or third-party administrators, including copays and deductibles paid by individuals for covered services. And we base this definition on how the sponsors of the insurer's proposal have described its workings to our representatives in DCBS, but we have not yet seen proposed provisions in statutory language. There's a lot of room for reinterpretation here. Further, direct payments for non-covered services, such as when an individual might purchase LASIK eye treatments or elective plastic surgery, would not be included in either premiums or claims. But there may be medical costs reflected in premiums that are not technically claims. For example, capitated payments to providers or contractual services that show up in premiums but are not treated as claims. Again, we don't have statutory language to review, only the explanations we've heard from the proponents of the claims assessment. But the effect of this difference between premiums and claims could have significant consequences. Kaiser charges premiums the way other insurers do, but it doesn't pay claims the way other insurers do. Therefore, it would pay a premium assessment as other insurers do, but it may escape much of the claims assessment paid by other insurers. A final example, if an insurance company were to pay incentive payments to providers for meeting quality care outcomes, these payments would be reflected in the base of a premium assessment, but they would not necessarily be picked up by claims assessment. So this leads to our concerns about the claims assessment proposal, which center on administrative efficiency, legality, eligibility for federal matching funds, and ultimate impact. Administrative efficiency, I think it's important to note that the boundaries of a claims assessment are uncertain because it's not clear what revenue would be captured by such an assessment. Of concern are the capitated payments and the contractual services noted above. A claims assessment could end up generating less revenue than you saw in that chart and could lead to litigation about what is included and what is excluded from the definition of a claim. Again, if we could see statutory proposed language on this, we might have clearer ideas of the boundaries. Second, legality. You've heard about the ERISA issue. Recent discussions suggest that the claims assessment may be able to overcome an ERISA challenge, as Dr. Goldberg said, but it's not a settled issue. Third, eligibility for federal match. Again, this will be a case of first impression for CMS. It may qualify or may not. The outcome here remains uncertain. Ultimate impact. The insurers propose that the claims assessment be paid by the insurer or claims payer so that the assessment on copays and deductibles paid by individuals would be shifted to the insurer or claims payer. We take them on their word on this, but again, we don't have a complete picture of how this will work or how its ultimate effect will play out on self-insured employers. It could be that self-insured employers would pay more than the assessment's nominal rate if that rate were to apply to copays and deductibles. Take the example of a self-insured employer who pays 80% of its employees' medical costs through its health benefit plan, while its employees pay the remaining 20% through copays and deductibles. If a 1% claims assessment were applied to that employer's claims, then that employer would pay 1% of 100% for an effective rate of 1.25% on what they're paying now. Now, some of our concerns can be answered in revised language if we see it. If you look at the Vermont model, the insurers may want to redefine claims and make sure that they bring capitated payments into their revenue stream and deal with this question of copays and deductibles. But time is not on our side at this point in the legislative process, and the concerns we have regarding legality cannot be resolved outside a courtroom. Finally, you'll hear other concerns tonight, I'm sure, about the equities or inequities involved in the choice between a premium assessment and a claims assessment. But the legal issues were telling when we finalized the governor's proposal, and the questions and concerns outlined above are the major reasons for our skeptical reaction to the claims assessment. But in summary, we appreciate the proposal advanced by the insurers, particularly the amount of revenue that they say their proposal would raise, because that revenue, if fully matched with federal funds, would go a long way in our effort to provide health care to Oregon's children and our most vulnerable adults, which is what this is all about. So thank you for the opportunity to describe our proposal. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
And thank you. You have a panel that you put together as well. Who's on that?
We have Tom Chamberlain, Rick Bennett, and Tim Galfia.
Okay, and you have a panel coming up. Can we bring...
Before they come up, yeah.
Sure.
I
do have about 30 people who are asking to be in, so I'm trying to save some people some time. So let's go.
I think that it's important for me to understand that we are asking for a certain segment of the population to provide a premium tax to pay, be responsible for covering our most vulnerable. But the claims tax is supposed to be more broad-based. I understand the idea that it raises the same amount of revenue. What I want to know is, will it have an impact on premiums? If we go with a premium tax, is it going to then raise premiums for those who have the large and small group and individual insurance, commercial insurance?
If you go to the claims tax, will that raise that same amount of cost?
Yes.
Chair Mona Sanderson, again, Carrie Barnett, for 3 minutes. The answer is yes. Either proposal I believe, would have an impact on premiums, and that ultimately it's the people who are purchasing insurance who will wind up paying these costs. So either way, it's going to flow through to the ultimate purchaser. However, one important wrinkle. One of the things we're all trying to accomplish here is to bring more people into the system. These are people who today obviously are getting sick or injured, and they wind up in an emergency room. They are getting treated, by and large, at hospitals. And what's happening is that's uncompensated care, and all those costs are being shifted over, and they're being reflected in commercial premiums. So what we would hope would occur is that because of the diminution, the decrease in the cost shift, that there would be an impact over time on a reduction in claims costs. Claims costs are what comprise insurance premiums. So as that cost shift is reduced, you would see a commensurate reduction in premiums. I don't believe it would be on a dollar-for-dollar basis. In other words, for every dollar paid in the tax, there would be a decrease in claims costs of a dollar. It would be less than a dollar, I believe. But there would be some impact that would work its way through the system that would have a downward pressure on premiums.
I guess the point I want to make, though, is if we go with the premium tax, we have the large and small group and individuals whose taxes will go up, but the self-insured will not.
That's correct. That's correct. Yes. Because they would not be touched by the premium tax. That's correct. However, they would get some benefit out of a reduction in the cost shift, because they would see that in their claims as well. So that,
yes, Dr. Bates.
Actually, I think the question to a great degree has been answered, because what I had not heard tonight was the effect of getting these people insured and treating them earlier in their illnesses, taking care of their chronic illnesses and keeping them out of the hospitals. These people are still getting treated. I think another point needs to be made about, though, is that most of these people are these are the most expensive people probably in our society to insure than some people that are over 80. And these people are going to be in managed care. Bringing them into managed care has the benefit, as we all expect, of lowered costs. Maybe not initially, there's some pent-up demand there, not initially, but also a lot of these patients would be treated for the first time for the mental health, drug and alcohol problems with federal match also. When presently, since they're not in Medicaid, they would not be getting that match. That's a benefit to the state more than it is to the insurers, but it is still a benefit to the insurers. If you have less people coming to your hospitals with mental health problems, being admitted to the hospital, going out and rotating back in again, and you actually get them into managed care, there's another savings there. Hard to calculate that savings. But the problem in healthcare right now is not just getting more people insured, it's the cost of healthcare, and this is a huge step forward for starting to reduce that cost. Whether it's a dollar for dollar, that's open to debate, but there is savings here. Thank you.
10% of healthcare costs are felt to be 10% of the healthcare premiums and the cost of healthcare is felt to be as a result of those who have insurance coverage or are self-insured paying for the care for the uninsured. And indeed, what all of these taxes is based on is the ability to do two things. One is to leverage the dollars from our federal partner to bring to Oregon and to help put into our healthcare system. And the other is to provide coverage for more individuals and therefore decrease the cost for everybody else. So that's what we're trying to nail down here.
President Maurer?
Representative Kennemer.
Thank you. Dr. Goldberg, I wondered if you could provide me with copies of the critical legal pieces underpinning your perspective on ERISA.
Chairs Greenlake, Moniz, Anderson, Representative Kenmer, I'd be happy to give you what I can legally. I mean, some of it.
Well, I mean, that's probably the limit we want to place on.
Yeah, but yeah. I'll try and dig up what I can.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I can. What I can certainly give you there are a couple of opinions we've looked at from Vermont that has a similar assessment that I can certainly provide you with. And I don't know whether any of the other parties, Ledge Council, has been involved in these discussions. And as your counsel,
I'm sure they'd be very happy to provide you with whatever written material they have for you as well. But I'll get you what I can.
I think it's fair to ask also what you have from them.
Whatever I can share, I'm happy to. Indeed.
There are some issues of attorney-client privilege that, between the day of
what's legal.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Montes Anderson asked, my first question was, who's going to pay this? And ultimately, it's a premium. And the second question is, who's not paying? Who's not paying? It's Medicare beneficiary isn't paying. Is that accurate? The Medicaid beneficiary wasn't paying before. They're not paying. The uninsured, they're not paying. So who's left? It's the commercial payers, correct? And regardless of which system we go with, it's commercial payer minus the self-insured, maybe they're included. What do we know about, for every percent increase in premium, how many people spin out of the system and now become uninsured? That's question number one.
Chair Greenlake and Montes Anderson, Representative Maurer, it's a very good point. We are very concerned about what the impact is on businesses, particularly small businesses, many of whom don't provide insurance today for their employees because they can't afford it. And then there are many small businesses who are kind of right at that tipping point, where as costs continue to go up, we've seen a shrinkage in the commercial market as a result. As economic times get worse, and there's less income on the part of particularly small businesses, we see a shrinkage in commercial coverage. So we're very concerned about what the impact might be as premiums continue to go up, even by a small degree.
Yeah, the other side of who pays is who benefits. You might comment on that.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Well, it's who benefits as well as who pays. That's always the question we ask, right? Who pays and who benefits?
Okay.
Well,
I do have a follow-up. The other question is, how much is this going to cost the state? Because the state pays it's a rough estimate of $2.3 billion of biennium in health insurance premiums for state employees, teachers, university system. So how much is the state going to pay for this tax? Has that been calculated? I'm thinking $35 million, just a rough estimate. But
and they're now paying $280 million in terms of
$280 million
in terms of the cost shift from the uninsured. That's yes, 10%.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
No, ma'am, Chair. If you want to look at the total budget for the state and look at it on a broader basis, you ask yourself also, in the Medicaid system, we are spending about $110 million in mental health right now, and a little more than that in drug and alcohol.
Senator Bates, correct, a little bit more.
A little more. We would cut that probably by a third. Maybe a little more than a third when these people become insured, because we get federal match for it. So the overall gain to the state is probably, in the neighborhood of $10 or $15 million.
Let's take one more question and then move on to the two panels. I'll ask each of the two panels to maybe take 10 minutes each, which will still leave us 40 minutes for other people who want to come up. So, Representative Harker, you had a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My fellow vice chair here, first question I thought was an excellent, they both were, but the first one I think we could get an answer to. We don't have to have it right now, but I would expect that since we look at premium cost increasing X percent per annum over however many years we care to look back, we could get an estimate of how many would spin out given a 1% rise if we look at those data. Don't we have access to things like that?
Chairs and Representative Harker, we can try and see what we can find out. I can't give you anything off the top of my head, and I think
I'd be amazed if you could.
But we can look at that. I think the other, issue here is there's certainly a payment, the tax piece, but then there's a concomitant benefit. And the question is going to be how and if those two are going to balance each other out. And I think that's been one of the more difficult things to answer in terms of this.
If I may, Chairs and Vice Chair Harker, in the study that was circulated a month or so ago by the Oregon Health Fund Board, a study done by an economist named John McConnell at OHSU, he factored that into his assessment of the impacts of both the hospital tax and the benefits of coverage from the premium assessment. And obviously, the benefits of covering 155,000 more people far outweighed what I think was an estimate of 1,000 or so of people who might otherwise not have health insurance in the commercial market. I think it's also important to remember that we look at these studies, which are done in a steady state, and we're not in a steady state, as you well know. We're in a declining economy where more people are losing their jobs and their health insurance. And if you look back to the experience we had between 2001 and 2003 in Oregon, we saw an increase in the number of uninsured, the increase alone in excess of 100,000. So we're likely to see, unfortunately, tens of thousands of more people losing their health insurance. This is a component of a package that can bring health insurance to over 150,000 Oregonians who are currently uninsured, and that's the benefit side.
Very, very briefly.
Well, okay. Let's just step back and take a look at this for a minute. We've had double-digit inflation in premium taxes and premiums paid for the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. We're talking about 1 or 1.5% increase. That's a drop in the bucket. And this one brings in a huge number of people that weren't insured before and the possibility of, in the future, tamping down that increase. So that argument for me is really null and void. When you're looking at, 10, 12, 11, 9, 8% increases year after year after year as a private payer, 1 or 1.5% more that has a possibility of lowering that in the future, to me, is a gimme. So either one of these plans from that point of view has real value here, and the number of people you might lose is really kind of insignificant in some ways. Real, but not a significant factor. We look at the entire picture. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Kerry, could you bring Dan Fields and
Steve Doty.
And Steve Doty, please.
Step back.
Chairs Greenlick and Mona Sanders, if we can go ahead and launch it. I know the time is short, and we'll try to go through this pretty quickly. I've already had a chance to speak a little bit, so I'm just going to make a couple of quick points, hopefully quick, and then cede my time. First of all, I just wanted to respond to some of Tim Nesbitt's comments, and I really appreciate what's behind his comments, and I appreciate the tone and approach that he and the governor have taken on this. Tim raised some issues that I would consider to be sort of the details of exactly how this would be put together. He's correct that we don't have bill language that spells all of this out in great detail, but we would be very interested in working with the committee and working with the governor's office to begin the process of putting together that level of detail. He raised some potential concerns, none of which sounded to me as though they were checkmates, and these are all issues that would need to be addressed as important details within the bill. So we would certainly be willing to take on the challenge of working with folks in order to spell that out in greater detail. As I said earlier, the question here is really whom to tax. And I just want to start by acknowledging that nobody wants to be taxed. No tax is popular. We certainly learned this on the Oregon Health Fund Board Finance Committee, which I chaired. And I want to be clear, speaking for the insurance industry at least, we don't like this tax either. We don't like the assessment that we're proposing, because we don't like paying taxes, and we don't like to see our members paying increased taxes or assessments either. I want to be clear that we're not making this proposal to try to avoid being taxed. In fact, under our proposal, Regents would be taxed more, when I say more, to
tune of several million dollars a year, we would be taxed more under the claims assessment approach than under a 1.5% premium tax approach. And it's also clear that, as we discussed, any tax exacerbates the cost issue. It simply drives up the cost of coverage, which we should be concerned about. But the goal here is a common goal. We've got to figure out how to increase access for kids and low-income adults. And we're here to be as collaborative as we can be in putting skin on the table and in coming forward with a proposal, even if it means that it's our ox that's being gored. We'd rather not pay a tax, but we recognize that that may be what it takes. All we would ask of this committee is that you hold everybody else to that same standard of being willing to come to the table, be collaborative, and even if that means that their ox might be gored by a new tax as well. We've talked about the key difference between the governor's premium tax proposal and our claims assessment. The key difference, of course, is that the claims assessment is broad-based in that it applies to everybody, whether self-insured or fully insured. Just to sort of drive home that point, I just want to illustrate it if I could. As you heard from Bruce Goldberg, by and large, the self-insured tend to be large groups. They tend to be large companies or large governmental entities in some cases. And the fully insured tend to be individuals, small businesses, and mid-sized businesses. So what this means is that under the governor's proposal, the health plan of a person who works for a small manufacturing firm would be taxed, but not the health plan of somebody who works for a large manufacturing firm, which happens to be self-insured. Under the governor's proposal, the health plan of a person who works for a gas station would be taxed, but the health plan of a person who works for a large oil company, self-insured, would not be taxed. The governor's proposal would tax the health plan of a person who works in a small convenience store, somebody who goes out and purchases insurance on their own, purchases an individual policy on their own with his or her take-home pay. But it wouldn't tax the health plan of a person who works for a large supermarket chain, for example, which happens to be self-insured. The governor's proposal would tax the health plan of a person who works in a small software consulting company, but not a very large technology company. And I could go on and on and on. I'll stop there. When we talk about kind of this basic issue of fairness and equity, that's what we're talking about, and it gives us great concern. At the end of the day, there's going to be a choice. And the choice, we believe, isn't really between these two proposals. The choice, we believe, is really between having a fair, equitable, broad-based tax versus no tax at all. And we understand that no tax at all means we can't move forward in achieving an increment in access that we're all trying to achieve here. But if you're looking for a path that everybody supports, it isn't going to be a narrow premium tax that the governor's put forward here. Insurers won't be able to support it, obviously. And we believe that the individuals, small and mid-sized businesses, won't be able to support it either if it means that they're going to have to pay, while large businesses, even large businesses in the same industry as they are, don't have to pay. That's really, I think, the summation of what we see as the issue around equity. I'll turn it over to Dan Fields.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. I'll skip the opening jokes and jump right into the testimony. Carrie talked a little bit about
Dan, introduce yourself, please.
I'll skip that, too, apparently. I'm Dan Field, Director of External Affairs for Kaiser Permanente. It's good to be here this evening. We appreciate the chance to talk to you about a really important issue for us. Carrie talked a little bit about fairness and equity, and I want to build on that by talking to you about sustainability and the sustainability of these two taxes. Obviously, our joint interest here is in creating a sustainable funding package that maximizes federal dollars. None of us want a tax that's inherently unsustainable and begins to collapse the minute we create it. I want to build on some of the questions that came from Representative Hark and Representative Maurer about the impact of this tax on small businesses, because I think that goes directly to the sustainability question. I looked hard for the information you were asking for today. I looked through several sources trying to find the connection between increased cost of health care and employer-sponsored insurance levels. We know there's a connection. We don't have that number. I know it's out there, and I'm committed to finding it for you. Here's what we do know. There's extensive data that documents that businesses are very sensitive to the price of health insurance. We know that particularly during challenging times, employers will drop health insurance as the price goes up. One recent study I did find said that from 2000 to 2007, there were declines both in the percentage of employers offering coverage and the percentage of employees in those firms that were able to enroll in the coverage based on their cost sharing. The declines in both of these areas were due primarily to the increased cost of coverage. Unfortunately, the decline is even more acute among small businesses, which are clearly even more susceptible to the fluctuations in the cost of healthcare insurance. We know that, for example, and here's a dramatic number, 63% of small companies, less than 200 employees, offered health insurance in 2008, so that's a little bit over half, compared to 99% of large firms. These trends are even more pronounced in low-income families, where the percentage of working insured in low-income families dropped from 66% to 58% just in the 7 years between 2000 and 2007. In blue-collar and service industries, that's where over 80% of uninsured workers are employed, the working uninsured. These are precisely the workers who would be most directly impacted by a narrow tax on fully insured premiums. Now, obviously, the link between the cost and the behavior shouldn't surprise us. One of the reasons I think we all like the tobacco tax, not only does it raise a lot of money, but the increase in cost forces people to stop smoking. That basic law of economics is going to apply here as well. Increased taxes discourage the behavior or the activity being taxed. If you put a tax on small businesses, they're less likely to offer coverage. Claims assessment, unfortunately, is not any kind of magic solution to this challenge, but it certainly mitigates the impact on small businesses and medium-sized businesses by, as Carrie noted, spreading the tax more broadly and therefore lowering the rate. It also, and I think this is an important point, it also eliminates the incentive for those medium-sized businesses who might move in this direction to leave the fully insured market and further shrink the fully insured tax base. Some people have suggested that the solution to the sustainability challenge I just outlined is to simply prevent insurers from passing through the tax to purchasers. Let's have a tax on insurer profit margins, and I feel it's important to address that. First of all, there's been a lot of confusion on this point. The proposal we saw from the governor last fall said there will be no pass-through of the insurance premium tax. A lot of pushback on that early this year. We heard, of course, you can pass through the insurance tax. It's the hospital tax that doesn't get passed through. And then just last week, we saw amendments to 2009 that said, well, you can pass through, and I quote, a portion of the assessment through to the customer base until June of 2011. So I'm not really sure what any of that means other than the fact that there's a lot of confusion about the pass-through issue. But even in the short run, a tax that is not passed through is not sustainable. Many of you have seen the DCBS report on insurance, health insurance. They publish this every year, and they have one out this January. It documents the cyclical nature of health insurance, and it talks very specifically about health insurer margins. During the first cycle, from 98 to 2002, the average profit margin of the eight largest insurers in Oregon was 1%. The second cycle, from 2003 to 2007, a similar four-year period, saw those eight insurers report slightly higher margins of a whopping 3%. If you follow that pattern, you realize that in 2008, where margins started to drop again, we're re-entering that low cycle, and the industry is returning to margins of 1%. Several large insurers represented in the room tonight had 0% or negative percent. So if history is a good predictor, those extremely low margins, 1%, 0% or less, will hold for the next 3 years. When you factor in the decrease in Medicare Advantage payments that the President and Congress are preparing, those margins will be even lower. We know that with average margins of 1% in the industry year after year, a 1.5% tax is clearly not sustainable.
Dan, we're about 15 minutes into your 10 minutes. If we could speed it up a bit.
I want to just cover a couple objections that have been raised, and then I'll close with that. Clearly, we're working through the legal issues. We know that Vermont has a tax that's similar. We know that the attorneys working on this have expressed confidence that we'll find that this tax is legal. A couple other concerns people have raised. this doesn't raise as much money as the governor's proposal. I think we saw tonight that, in fact, it raises more money than the premium proposal. There's an argument that self-insured plans and Taft-Hartley-Trust should not be taxed. You're going to hear about this more tonight. And in honor of the chairman, who's used this phrase several times, I refer to this as the don't tax me, tax the fellow behind the tree argument. It's a great shorthand way of capturing the essence of their objection. No one likes to pay taxes, and I understand that. The argument that they're already offering comprehensive coverage and shouldn't have to pay this tax, I think, falls flat on its face. And I want to address something that Senator Montes Anderson mentioned. Kaiser Permanente alone has over 35,000 members who are in employer plans alongside self-insured plans. So, in fact, a number of large employers, even in one plan, cover their employees both through fully insured plans and self-insured plans. Our proposal would treat all of those employees equally. Governor's proposal would not. Finally, I'll close with this. You know, I think one of the concerns I have is really unrelated to the provider tax. We know that the more important work that we're all doing here this session is really to build towards our long-term vision, a vision outlined by the Health Fund Board report, the seven building blocks of reform that they outlined in the report. This is a shared vision that we all have related to better management of chronic disease, integrated health homes, evidence-based medicine, improving end-of-life care, bills that you're working on this very week. Our ability to deliver on those reforms as a state really depends in large part on a stable, organized healthcare delivery and financing system. And I think it depends on systems like Kaiser to effectively manage our collective energy and resources and help us deliver on this systems, on this promise. Organizations like Kaiser are innovating on health IT. We're already conducting and implementing comparative effectiveness research. We're continually refining evidence-based practice guidelines that promote patient safety and improved health outcomes. And the sad part for me in all this is that if we target these very same managed care plans and their customers with a narrow tax, we'll lose the momentum that we need to build around many of these innovations. So let's not do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Mona Sanderson and Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. In the interest of time, I will be brief. Some of the points I wanted to make have already been made. But my name is Steve Doty. I am representing the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters, which is an organization of insurance agents and brokers who represent fully insured plans and self-funded plans here in the state of Oregon. I'm also I own my own insurance agency in Portland, Northwest Employee Benefits. And our agency insures over about 700 small and medium-sized employers who provide insurance for their employees. On this issue, I attempted to contact most of my clients, let them know what was going on to get their opinion on things, and I heard from them, and I suspect you will too. And of course, none of them were happy about any kind of a tax, but looking at the alternatives, the issue really to them was fairness. Many of them do the very difficult thing of providing insurance in this difficult economy. It's very difficult for them to pay premiums. They're doing a lot of things to try to maintain their costs and lower their costs. So I'm their voice today. I wish they were here, but they're not here. They're busy running their business, so I'll speak on their behalf. My clients are smart people. They understand a lot of things, but understanding this very complicated issue of funding the Oregon Health Plan and provider taxes and federal matching funds is very difficult. The average person doesn't understand that. But my clients do understand the principle of fairness. And there's no doubt that either one of these proposals is going to result in increased premiums for my clients. And if the small employer, those that are buying fully insured plans, are going to be asked to fund Oregon Health Plan expansion, it's only fair that we ask the self-funded large employers and the self-funded Taft-Hartley Trust to also contribute. According to Dr. Goldberg's proposal or his presentation, about 30% of the people who are covered by insurance in Oregon are covered by self-funded plans. Allowing them to escape the tax is not only unfair, but it's also a poor way to create a sustainable tax base. I also served on the Finance Committee for the Oregon Health Fund Board, and it was interesting. We looked at a wide variety of different tax proposals to help fund health care reform. And there was, as you might imagine, there was quite a bit of different opinion about who and what to tax. But one thing was in agreement, and that is the tax needed to be equitable and sustainable. And in order to satisfy those conditions, it needed to be broad-based. A premium tax does not meet this test. There are a lot of reasons why large employers decide to self-fund. One is it's an opportunity for them to avoid Oregon state insurance mandates. For example, Oregon's mental health parity law is a reason. But allowing them to avoid this premium tax is one more reason for a large employer to leave the fully insured plan and go to self-funding. This will mean that the small employers will have to accept more and more of the burden as the tax base continues to shrink. Their only option, because they don't have an option of self-funding, is to either bear this burden or drop the coverage. I think the only fair way to pay for this is really through the claims tax, so that all employers will participate equally. Now, in closing, I'd like to sort of switch hats here as a broker and also speak to you as an employer myself. I own my own insurance agency. I have employees. We're a small employer. But my business is a union shop. I have a labor agreement, and my employees are union members of the union, and we participate in a large self-funded Taft-Hartley Health and Welfare Trust. Under the premium tax proposal, my business would avoid paying that tax. But I also understand the principle of fairness. And I don't think it's fair for me to not pay that tax while asking the clients that I represent to pay that tax. So I think in the interest of fairness, everybody should participate equally in this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tim, we had Tim Gauthier and Tom Chamberlain. I'll be back there. Who is the third, please? Rick Bennett. Keep the 10 minutes if we can.
Chairman Greenlick, Chairman Marcus Anderson, Joint Committee members. My name is Tim Gauthier. I'm with the National Electrical Contractors Association in Portland, Oregon. I am also the chairman of the Harrison Health Fund, a Taft-Hartley ERISA self-funded and insured program. We cover approximately 400 small businesses in the state of Oregon and Southwest Washington. Approximately 6,000 electricians are covered under our plan. And this plan has been in operation since 1954. I've been the chairman of the plan since 1982 when we went self-insured in 1983. We do provide insured products to our participants as well as our self-insured trust. We feel strongly that we should stay with the premium tax for a different reason. If we have this claims tax on our trust fund, this will continue to drive us back to the table for negotiations, and the dollar is either going to come out of the electrician's pocket or the contractor's pocket. The question was raised earlier, who benefits? The people who benefit are those who we compete against who do not provide health insurance at all. There's that third leg of the stool that has completely been neglected over this whole issue. Their employees are going to go and get the coverage by the taxes that we're going to end up paying. Nobody wants to bring them to the table, but we're saying it's time they be brought to the table as well. If our 400 small businesses can provide family health coverage, our competitors can as well. And what we're doing is driving our competitive posture between who we represent and the rest of the industry further apart. More of our people probably won't continue to be employers represented by us if we continue to have to pass these taxes on, and our competitors don't at all. They benefit, and they're being ignored. We really wish that you would look at them as well. We would prefer the premium tax over the claims tax for that reason.
Thank you, Mr. Chamberlain.
Chair Monis Anderson, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Tom Chamberlain, and I'm president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, representing over 200,000 working Oregon families. What's interesting about today is we're not talking about if we're going to expand coverage, it's how we're going to expand coverage. And you have two options in front of you today, two ways to fund expanding coverage to uninsured children and low-income adults. And as you walk down the path to your decision on what's the best option, I hope you keep in mind the goals and objectives of the Oregon Health Fund Board. Provide coverage to as many Oregonians as possible. A premium tax as proposed by the governor is compliant with the new CMS rules for federal matching funds. Every penny collected can be used to bring in the maximum amount of federal dollars to expand coverage, while the insurer's claims tax proposal has no precedent in the CMS world. Their proposal would be a first test case. Slow the increase in health care costs, or as we said on the Oregon Health Fund Board, flatten the curve. Our member unions support the governor's hospital provider tax and insurance premium tax because we believe the more we shift revenue for coverage expansion from the hospitals to the insurers, the more we facilitate the pass-through of cost to the customers, to the consumers. Hospitals, which recover the assessment through increased payments, will have little or no additional cost to pass on.
Somebody's phone is not off.
While a claims tax, we believe that a claims tax will absolutely be passed through, but a small insurance premium tax could be absorbed by the insurers. Whether or not that will occur will be part of any process used for determining whether or not to increase proposed rates. And you must consider that self-insurers, by the nature of their business model, have low administrative costs, and it makes it very difficult for them to absorb the claims increase. We believe that the current claims tax is illegal under ERISA, and I have a number of building trades folks behind me that support that. A claims tax is essentially a sales tax on health care insurance claims. Every Oregonian will have to carry the weight of the increase. You know, my member unions have followed the progress of the Oregon Health Fund Board when they adopted the provider tax as a funding mechanism for the expansion of the Oregon Health Fund Board. And what they've been listening very carefully to your deliberations. As of today, firefighters, construction workers, office workers, factory workers, and their unions, and these are folks who have both self-insured plans and purchase insurance through a company, are opposed to the claims tax and support the governor's proposal. Yes, you have two options before you today. The governor's proposal, which is compliant with federal guidelines for matching funds, or the claims tax that will face legal challenge either at the CMS process or a ERISA challenge. We encourage you to support the governor's proposal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bennett?
Thank you, Co-Chairs Monis Anderson and Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP. I'm sure I can be brief. I always find that as it gets later in the day, my comments get shorter and shorter. So I'll get right to the point. The goal here is to provide funding to increase access, reduce the number of uninsured in Oregon. Two proposals. We've had quite a bit of time to review the governor's proposal and find that it is in keeping with our general taxation policies and the goals of increasing access. We've had less time, but we have reviewed at least the general concept related to the claims assessment and find that it is also in keeping with our public policy related to taxation. And indeed, as mentioned earlier, at least in theory, they both generate a similar amount of funding. So really, I think it gets to the more practical questions. The insurance assessment, I believe, is proven. It does what it does. It generates the amount of money. The administration of the assessment is known and so forth. The claims assessment, on the other hand, is not proven. as we've already heard from several people, there are a number of questions related to whether it can be sustained legally, whether in fact it will generate the federal matching funds. We won't know that until we get a clear answer from CMS. And I would just say, you know, it was impressed upon me at a meeting a little earlier this evening that there are 13 weeks left in this session. The clock is running, and I don't believe any of the questions related to the claims assessment is going to be answered in those 13 weeks. So I think you have a proven approach for generating the funds you need to increase the coverage for children in this state, and I would urge you to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gauthier. Thank you. I'd like to just address Mr. Gauthier's issue. And I believe with time, I'm hoping that we will mandate insurance, health insurance for everyone at some point in time. We're taking, I think, baby steps this time, but that is an issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
2011.
Right.
Thank you very much. We got lists from each side of advocates, and we'll call some from each, but there were three folks who signed up, asked to sign up individually, and I'll ask them to join us. I saw Ellen Pinney. Is she still back there? Arthur Towers? Have I seen him? Is Arthur here? Okay, and Joe Zier, I see.
I'm here.
Yeah. And basically, the rules we're asking you to do is to, if you prefer one or the other, let us know that. If you want to talk about something else, save that for a different time. So, because we're trying to deal with the question of what's on both sides of this. So we're happy to hear somebody say both words. Mrs. Zier, will you start, please? And please, I'm going to start timing folks with 3 minutes now.
Chairman Sanderson, Chair Greenlick, and committee members. My name is Joe Zier. I'm a member of the Mid-Valley Healthcare Advocates, and I represent that organization here today. We have no financial interest in this legislation. We neither gain nor lose money depending upon the outcome of these bills before you now. Our goal is to accomplish the triple aim. We've heard that a little bit earlier this evening. That means improving the health of all Oregonians, minimizing the per capita costs of health care, and maximizing the patient experience in terms of effective treatment, patient safety, and patient satisfaction. We use this goal as a benchmark when we evaluate the bills you discuss here, and we hope you will adopt these same principles for your own guiding light as you struggle to serve the people of Oregon under these extraordinary economic conditions. We also believe that health care should be delivered in a fair and equitable manner, and that's why we sit here before you now. This evening we've heard testimony about two plans, and I'm not going to pretend to review those for you. They both raise about the same amount of money by means of a tax to pay for health insurance for some needy people. But there's an important difference. In the first plan, a tax is collected from health care providers, used to obtain matching funds from the federal government, and then used to buy health insurance for some of our citizens who have no health insurance. These newly insured people go to providers as new paying customers to get health care, resulting in an increase of income for providers. This increased business effectively returns the provider tax back to the provider. I suspect that most of us would gladly sign on to an arrangement that returned our taxes to us as income over the next year. In the alternative plan, a medical claims tax is levied on providers, as well as other suppliers of medical insurance, such as labor unions and self-insured companies. The tax collected works the same as in the first plan, with the increased business accruing to providers, effectively refunding the tax they paid. But the labor unions and the self-insured companies do not get increased business as a result of the tax they pay. their so-called refund gets paid to the providers. In some circles, that kind of arrangement is called getting the short end of the stick. The Mid-Valley Healthcare Advocates looks to our legislators, to you, to pass fair and equitable laws. Nobody likes to pay taxes, but taxes are a necessary part of our society. When taxes must be levied, we ask you to make them fair and equitable. If neither of these bills is judged to be fair and equitable, perhaps we should consider finding another alternative. Thank you for putting my testimony.
Very well.
Chair Greenlick, Chair Montes-Anderson, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. My name is Arthur Towers, Political Director for Service Employees Union Local 503. And I want to put our union on record in support of the provider tax. We're in a once-in-a-lifetime financial crisis, or hopefully once-in-a-lifetime, and a real once-in-a-blue-moon opportunity to expand coverage. And our sense is that to maximize the federal matching funds and draw those down with some certainty that the provider tax would get that accomplished. We're also concerned about the realities of the legislative timeline, and you've heard testimony about that before. But again, we're really worried. You look at our membership base, we have a large number of our members, a large number of our families who are uninsured. And this is going to be an opportunity for them to get an opportunity at coverage, an opportunity for many of our members' clients to get coverage. And we feel there's a great deal more certainty with the provider tax as a way to go to make sure that coverage gets provided. So I'll abbreviate my remarks and end right there.
Arthur, thank you very much. Helen?
My name is Ellen Pinney. I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Health Action Campaign, and I appreciate this time with you today. We would support any proposal that will get us to cover the 180,000 lives. We would support one of these two proposals that would get us to cover 180,000 lives as originally proposed, be legally sustainable, and be able to draw down without delay the full federal match that's available to our state without jeopardizing losing any of that federal match to other states because of the if you don't use it, you lose it kind of clause within CHIP as it stands now. I think there's really only one proposal before you that meets all of those criteria right now. Beyond that, I would just add that many advocacy organizations are concerned about the clause that has been added to 2009 allowing for assessments to be passed through to payers, both small businesses and individuals who buy insurance. I strongly believe that with or without that clause, companies can already pass through costs to consumers and have. As a small business, we have seen double-digit rate hikes, and I'm amazed that the laser beam focus on this particular 1% assessment or 1.5% assessment has obfuscated the 25% rate hike that Blue Cross Blue Shield requested for its small business and individual rate holders this year and many other insurance carriers having that same kind of rate hike. I believe strongly that if we cover 180,000 currently uninsured Oregonians in increased reimbursement to providers, we as small businesses and individuals should see and be rewarded with a reduction in the rate of increase in our insurance premiums. And we believe that the only way to assure that that's going to happen is through the establishment of an authority that creates public accountability for the cost savings that all Oregonians should expect to see from these expansions. Thank you.
So you said premium tax? Is that what you're advocating for?
Yes, Senator Wendy Sanderson.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Can we have David Moffenbier, Kelsey Wood, and John Worshesser? Go for it.
Good evening, Chair Greenlick and Chair Montes Anderson. For the record, my name is Dave Mockenbauer. I'm the founder of a company called Absorbent Technologies, which is a five-year-old Oregon startup with 70 employees, 20 in Beaverton and 50 in a factory in Albany. We're a green company. We're making a starch-based superabsorbent that grows 10% more food with 10% less water. So exactly what the governor wants. As I said, we operate a factory in Albany, which has been interesting to bring up. My work in Oregon dates back to 1981 when I founded a company called Mentor Graphics, which was fairly successful and got to the point where we could be self-funded. I was the CFO at the time, and we made that choice. Since then, I've started four other companies. None of them have gotten as successful as Mentor Graphics, and so, you know, we've had regular insurance. I'm on the board of Providence Health Plan, and we're insured with Providence Health System. I have one observation and one question. My observation is, it's really tough out there right now as a startup. Young company, you go to the bank for a loan, they say no. You go to get accounts receivable financing, they say no. You go to get an equipment loan, they say no. And your health care insurance is going up 10 or 20%. We have the additional challenge of we compete with companies that are larger, better funded, that can offer full insurance for all their employees. So for example, I'll train an employee for 2 years, they'll get experience. I can only afford to offer insurance for the employer. They go to Wachang, big, you know, strong union company, they get full insurance. So there is a cost, and it's very expensive for a startup like us to do that. My question is, I'm getting ready to renew my insurance July. Risk rates are going up. How do I stand up in front of my 70 employees and say, our rates are going to go up an additional 1.5%, but they aren't going up for anybody at Intel, anybody at Nike, anybody at my old company, Mentor Graphics, Portland Teachers. The biggest and the strongest companies don't have to pay more, and we do. And it's the small companies that President Obama says, we got to make them successful, they provide all the new jobs, and I just think that is a very unfair tax. And I don't know how you would answer that question if any of the owners of 80,000 small companies here in Oregon, how do you answer, we're not going to tax Nike, Intel, or a lot of the larger companies in town?
Thank you.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Worcester. I'm here on behalf of the Health Policy Committee for Associated Oregon Industries, and also for my daytime employer, which is IRRAS, Oregon Steel Mills. First, I've circulated a list of health policy principles that AOI's Health Policy Committee has adopted. I don't want to go through the whole thing. There wouldn't be time, just two pieces of it. First, just stepping back for a minute, returning to a point that Dr. Bates brought up earlier. Comprehensive health care reform is cost, access, and quality. Tonight, you're dealing mainly with the access piece of it, you know, a piece of the access, a little bit of the cost, but primarily access. I encourage the committee and its overall deliberations to think about costs as well as quality. Second piece, the item 9, the provider and insurance taxes that's in this health policy principles that's being circulated. This is where the Health Policy Committee for Associated Oregon Industries thinks the criteria should be for evaluating the competing proposals, and we would come down on the side of the claims tax. We think it's more equitable, as has been described here, whether you're insured or self-insured. We think it's more broad-based, which is a good idea. We also think it's more transparent. I mean, think of your phone bill or your energy bill that has, you know, 1% excise tax added to it. That's about as transparent as you can get. Shifting my role to the Director of Benefits and Compensation of Rivers Oregon Steel Mills, we have about 650 employees in Oregon. We've got a mix of both self-insured through Dan Field's company, Kaiser, and then we also use Regence Securities, a company as a TPA for our self-insured group. You know, the cost is going to be pretty similar, whether it's the claims tax or the premium tax. I think the claims tax, again, is the more equitable, you know, fair weight way to go. We're going to pay the tax either way. 1%, not a big number, as Dr. Bates said, but we think, again, the claims tax is the fair and better way to go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, Representative Greenlick and Senator Moss Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me tonight. My name is Kelsey Wood. I'm an insurance agent from Roseburg, Oregon. I've been doing this for 27 years. I insure 2 to 50 groups and groups over 50. I buy this stuff. I sell this stuff. I use this stuff. I'm a small business owner with 6 employees. I pay 100% for my employee and their dependents. I'm a member of the National Federation of the Independent Businesses. I'm a member of the Legislative Committee for the Professional Insurance Agents Association. I'm a member of the Association of Health Insurance Agents. Why am I here? It was 2.5 hours to get here. I said goodbye to my family earlier. Because I think we can fix the system. But I think we have to proceed wisely and carefully, smartly. Let me explain a little difference to what either of these two taxes do. I want to point out that the difference between self-insured groups versus insured groups, self-insured union and association plans, these self-insured union and association plans rates are subject to loss ratios and expenses. The insured plans are not. They're pooled. Insured plans aren't subject to their own loss ratio. And what happens is self-insured groups are groups that have lower claims ratios, healthier groups, if you will, for whatever the situation is, can pull out of the pool. And now we have a disparate situation. We have groups that are more expensive having to stay in the pool. And we have lower cost groups pulling out of the pool and getting into self-insured and avoiding taxes and mandates. This premium tax is going to exacerbate that. It's going to put more of the burden on the insured plans who are already having a hard time. And it's not going to put any of the burden on the self-insured groups, union plans, and association plans. So it's a matter of public policy to find revenues through increasing taxation. A wise and more more fair tax would be a broad-based tax, not one just on insured premiums, but one on claim payments, assessment on claims payments. We want to spread the tax throughout all health plans, not just part of them, not just for more costly insured plans subject to mandates, assessments, and unable to move to a lower cost alternative. An example of is one of my clients, Adapt Inc. in Roseburg. ADAPT is a drug and alcohol counseling center. They have over 100 lives. Because of the makeup of their employees, whatever the situation they have, their loss ratio is not great. They're subsidized. They're an insured group. Is that my 3 minutes up? Don't put the burden on groups like that. Don't hurt the system. Please consider the claims payment assessment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I call Jennifer Schmidt, Julia Bringett Edwards, and Bob Shipwreck?
You did not?
I did not.
You want to? Somebody put you on a list.
Okay. How do I get up here?
Go for it.
Good. Chair Greenlick, Chair Moss Anderson, committee members, I'm Jennifer Schmidt, President and CEO of A&I Benefit Plan Administrators in Portland, Oregon. I'm the owner and CEO of A&I, and we are a third-party administrator of employee benefit plans. We, small employers and large employers, hire us to administer their benefit programs for both health and pension benefits. My company is a small business, and we serve over 400 small employers. 80% of those employers have less than 30 employees. Many people do not know that TPAs exist, or they don't understand what they do, yet according to the Society of Benefit Plan Administrators, about 55% of U.S. workers with non-federal health and pension employee benefits are on plans using some degree of third-party administration. Not all TPAs are alike. My company is very different than a Regions TPA model. Traditional independent TPAs are privately held small businesses. Unlike the large insurance carriers who are publicly owned and have a broader base. Some other key differences are typically locally owned, managed, hands-on leadership as opposed to a multi-tiered bureaucratic, multi-layered organizational structure. We also have a smaller client base, typically regional. Again, we're a large insurance carrier, has clients across the country. And revenue stream. Our revenue stream comes strictly from administrative fees paid to us by our clients. Large insurance carriers have, if they're providing self-funded claims administration under a TPA model, they may have administrative fees. Provider utilization, revenue through networks, and typically they also underwrite the stop-loss premium and receive revenues from that source. We'd like to make you aware of the serious impact of a claims tax on the TPA industry, independent TPA industry, and small clients that ANI serves. The tax will have a trickle-down effect to the employees. We're already struggling to provide health insurance. Would result in increased cost to employees, a decrease in benefits, or the complete elimination of benefits altogether. Employees whose health plans are compromised because of a claims tax will end up uninsured or underinsured, exaggerating the problem. It has a negative impact on the TPA industry. Privately held TPAs like mine are small. We don't have a broad client base like insurance carriers do. We have low profit margins, smaller client base to spread our costs. If this tax is passed, we'd have to pass it back directly to the employers we serve, most of which are in Oregon. And if my clients refuse to pay the tax because they feel it's an ERISA violation, I can't afford that liability. I would go out of business. It's inequitable. As many people have said here earlier, the employers that are not providing taxes are not at this table. And I, along with the companies I serve, are competing with employers that don't provide coverage. I have 70 employees. I managed to figure out how to pay for insurance for the entire family, not just the employees. There's no guarantee of federal match under a claims payment tax. And lastly, we feel that it violates ERISA. Because of its direct administrative and financial impact on ERISA plans, the proposed legislation is preempted. It would be imposed on third-party administrators whose very reason for existence is to administer health plans. Although the tax would be imposed on the TPAs and not the plans, it's clear that the cost of the claims tax will have to be passed on to the plans being administered. Therefore, the taxes do have an effect of regulating the plan itself.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Shiprock?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Shiprock, Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. I'll be very brief because so many things that I wanted to say have already been mentioned. I do have a piece of handout that you can read. It's really good. I just
does that mean you didn't write it?
I just wanted to... And I wanted, some of you probably know this, but back in the 80s, I volunteered for the House Human Resources Committee under the able chairmanship of the late Representative Shirley Gold, and we discussed these issues. I worked on the original implementation of the Oregon Health Plan. And there was a couple things mentioned today, and as a former person who had a vote around here, it's just some things that's come to mind, and one person mentioned it. We used to seek federal waivers a lot because we were experimenting with our healthcare system in this state. I never heard of us getting a waiver in 30 days. It usually meant if you were lucky, you got it the next legislative session, maybe. So I'd check into these timelines. The other thing that really bothers me is whether or not this money would even be matchable. You're kind of rolling the dice here. The ERISA preemption issue cannot be discounted, and it's somewhat troubling to hear people say, well, maybe we can, maybe we won't. It's not a threat or anything else, but should the tax on claims go forward, I would suggest that there would be a federal court suit filed immediately in order to test the legality of that. I don't know how it'll end up, but that's what would happen. I'm glad that it was spoken that a lot of the people in the TPAs, for at least the ERISA trusts, are small businesses, and I'm not going to belabor that anymore. But the only point I'd like to make, and Chair Greenlick mentioned it, and I keep hearing about 2011. I just want to tell you, I volunteered this to some legislators. I've had extensive experience in payroll taxes for workers' compensation and unemployment insurance. There's got to be a better way to fund health care than this, what we're doing today. And I'd really like to go to that kind of a model, get to working on something that's, if you want to talk about sustainable, is real and does some real good. My only advice to you, if I could be so brave, is we can't play three-card Monty with this issue and throw something out there that we find out 18 months from now won't work. We can't leave that money going to other states. We've got to make the right decision and ensure 180,000 people with a plan we know will work. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Bob, thank you. We've got eight more people, and I'm willing to stay, and anybody else is willing to stay, would be glad to put that testimony on the tables, I mean on our record. So let me call now Ellen Lowe, David Ezell, and Jim Graham. Do you have a question? Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either of the people who just testified might know the answer to this, or many other people in the room might know. What I'm wondering about is the breakdown of the 611,000 self-insured into those that are employees of large companies, those that are employees at small businesses aggregated together in the unions and elsewhere. So if anyone who's going to testify knows that, or anyone who is just testified and could provide it, I'd be curious.
Can we get that information? That'd be...
Or Corey Streisinger, who's in the back of the room. She might be able to answer it.
I don't think anybody's going to be able to answer that off the top of their head.
She can. She can.
Can't answer it right now, but we may be able to get it later.
That's a hard question. Ellen, you going to start?
Okay. Chair Laurie, Mona Sanderson, Chair Mitch Greenlick, and members of the Senate Health Care and Veteran Affairs Committee and House Health Committee. I'm Ellen Lowe, community advocate for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems and the people they serve. And just a personal note, if I may, my participation in healthcare in the public square goes back to the 87-89 interim, then a series of work groups on Senate Bill 27, followed by some 14 years on the Health Services Commission. I also served on the Insurance Pool Governing Board when we put together FEOP. I also served this last year, actually 14 months, as chair of the Enrollment and Eligibility Committee for the Oregon Health Fund Board. And as such, I was able to participate with the board during their deliberations. Now, those 14 months were a time of listening and sharing within committees. Issues were indeed massaged in a most respectful way by purchasers, major and minor insurers, consumers, providers, and advocate. And I really encourage you to look at the membership of all of those committees to see that they really did include all the interests that you see within this room tonight. And I'd like to say it was the public interest. Now, remembering those days of inquiry, I really want to encourage you to follow up on something you discussed very early this evening, and that's to do some real inquiry about some of the, what some may call a red herring, what others may say are legitimate questions, but to look into the claims proposal so that if you would engage yourself in the same kind of inquiry as those committees did, I'm sure you would find many of the your questions answered. Now, the Hospital Association really did participate during the process of the Oregon Health Fund Board, and you have had distributed to you before the principles where they acknowledge the need for reform. They also call for a long-term commitment to any new system that meets our goals of adequate overall financing and long-term sustainability. And they call for financing for government-sponsored health care coverage that comes from a broad-based funding source. I have brought with me part of Senate Bill 329. I encourage you to go look at the whereases, and I think you will see that the claims proposal that has been brought to you meets that requirement, really, for a broad-based participation so that we can all share in the responsibility for providing health care. Bob Shiprack is correct. Now, I know that some of
you
have received letters that have said stand up.
Your 3 minutes are up.
Stand up to hospitals and to insurers. I ask you to stand with them.
Thank you.
Chairs, committee meeting, members, my name is Jim Graham. My wife and I are owners of Graham Aviation, a flight school in Salem, Oregon. Our company currently has no employees other than me and my wife. We did have two who were let go due to the declining economy. Being a very small business, we had to struggle to provide benefits to our employees. Health insurance was not a benefit we were able to afford. My wife and I actually have some health insurance through a high deductible plan and an HSA. I understand that Oregon is considering a health care reform to expand access, cost controls, and improve the quality of health care. In this economic climate, we need to be very cautious. And it's even more important that we accomplish the reform without adding more layers of cost and layers of regulation to small business, who is suffering mightily under the current economic situation. The issue before us is how will we find funding coverage for some of Oregon's uninsured. While no individual or business, like myself, likes to pay more taxes, I recognize that when new taxes can't be avoided in these lean economic times, it is important that any tax be broad-based and fair to all, because we're all taxpayers, let's face it, and we all need to do our fair share in paying the taxes and carrying the water for health care. In this case, the governor's premium proposal does not meet these principles. It is not broad-based. It's not fair. It will adversely impact insured individuals and insured small businesses who can't escape its reach. The pool of insured individual small employer groups will continue to shrink as companies grow larger and move to self-funding, leaving the small business person to bear the full weight of this regulation and law and tax. Those of us who are left to pay the tax will have to consider whether we can continue purchasing coverage for ourselves and our employees. Clearly, Oregon small business cannot afford the impact of health insurance premium tax. It won't touch the large self-insured businesses or labor trust. The proposed claims processing assessment is more fair, more broad-based, alternative that will spread the tax burden across a wider base to all of us who have to pay the tax. I thank you for consideration. I would appreciate that if you would take what I've said to heart, because I am the face of small business here, and we are suffering. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Good evening, Chair Anderson and Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Dave Ezell, and I'm co-owner of an Oregon-based propane company. We are a small business. Our name is Co-Energy Propane, LLC. Our company has two offices. We service the Willamette Valley out of a Corvallis office, and we have an office in Redmond servicing Central Oregon. We have approximately 14 employees, 11 of them, all of our full-time employees. We pride ourselves in providing medical and dental coverage along with other benefit packages. As a small business, we compete with national companies that are based outside of Oregon, and they sometimes have 2,000 and 3,000 employees. Some of them, I believe, are self-insured, and some of them, most of them are all outside of the state of Oregon. I understand the discussion tonight is about how to pay for health care reform. A premium tax would affect individuals and small businesses like my own much more than a large company, as has been noted tonight. Several companies have been listed. If this bill were to pass, it makes it much harder for smaller companies to bear the brunt when some companies are not paying anything into this system. A premium tax will make it harder to provide the best medical coverage. As has been stated tonight, premiums go up every year, and we have to make choices. Can we still insure people? Do we have to change coverages? Do we have to drop some of the coverages we've had in the past? Those are hard decisions for businesses to make that really care about their employees and their families. It would make it more difficult to compete with these larger companies that we now compete with. We already have economies of scale that each year and decade get further out of sync and makes it harder for us to compete. This would just be one more nail in the coffin as something that I have to pay for and they do not have to pay for. And the one thing I'd like to close with, I'd like to say thank you for your consideration, but there's one thing I'd like to note that hasn't been said but once tonight. We're all trying and talking about insuring 180,000 lives of people, Oregonians. We all admit that that's what we want to do. But what would be fair is that the 2 million people that do have coverages need to all pay to get to that goal, not a portion of the 2 million people that are currently insured. Not 1 million of them, 1.5. I am not a statistician. I do not know the exact numbers. I don't want to misrepresent. Please don't understand it's me knowing those exact facts. But the bottom line is, why should a portion of the 2 million that have coverage, not all of the 2 million, help get those 180,000 people insured?
Thank you. Perfect timing. I'd like to call Pete Savage, Sherry Harris, and Pat Maloney.
Go ahead.
Chair Greenlick and Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Patrick Maloney. I'm an owner of Tice Electric Company, a Portland-based employer. We employ roughly 100 people throughout the Oregon area. We provide health insurance for all our employees and their families. I'm against the tax on claims. While I believe in covering more Oregonians, this is not the correct way to do this. This method of funding is wrong. This funding plan continues to further disincentivize the good companies and employers from providing our employees and workers with coverage. Why should we continue to pay for health care when many of our competitors don't, and we are taxed to cover their employees, agents, contract workers, or whatever term they conveniently use to skirt their responsibility? Please bring this group to the table. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Cherry Harris. I'm with the Operating Engineers, Local 701. I'm not going to read my testimony because I also have brought these lovely copies for all of you to take home and read before you go to bed. So I will just touch on some highlights. I'm here to express strong opposition to the claims tax proposal. I served for 9 months on the Finance Subcommittee, and during that time I learned way more about provider taxes and claims taxes than I ever wanted to know, and I'm not a, frankly, a
much of a fan of either one of them, because no one through this whole 9 months on that committee was able to convince me that it was not, in essence, a sales tax on health care that's only paid by the employers and the people, employers providing health care and people picking up their own plans. I just think that's wrong when we have so many people who don't have any health coverage at all, and their employers, many employers not providing, still won't be required to provide, won't be required to pay for it either. We have about 300 signatory employers. That covers about 4,000 members and their families. That includes retirees. It's primarily self-funded Taft-Hartley Fund, but we do have some insurance plans included in that. Our employers are truly the victims in this scenario because they fully provide all those benefits for those families. So now we're asking them to pay again, and that's just flat wrong. Just in case you might be thinking that these are big employers, large, profitable companies, I hate to tell you that's not the truth. And in fact, 75% of our membership, of our signatory employers, only have 10 employees or less. I've sort of, listening to this tonight, I feel like, who can go the lowest? I think I've got the lowest percentage rate. And we all agree that this healthcare system is broken, it's not sustainable in its current form, has to be fixed, and we have no problem helping to pay for that. Here's the problem. As long as we have a system that only some, it's an employer-based system, and only some employers pay, we got a problem. We need to bring fairness to this system, and we're already paying the lion's share of the cost shift, and now we're being asked to pay again. So this is a major problem, and our employers have to operate on an unfair playing field, and you know, pretty soon it's the tipping point, and it just breaks the bank. So I'm not a huge fan of either of these proposals. The Finance Subcommittee recommended that the lion's share of the money for health reform funding needed to come from a payroll system with a payer-pay mechanism. I don't see any of that on the table. That's a problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, Chair Montes-Anderson, my name is, for the record, Pete Savage. I'm the regional manager of the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters, 5,500 members across Oregon. I also sit on our healthcare trust, which covers over 16,000 lives here in Oregon. It was interesting tonight to hear that 10% of our healthcare claims are going to cover the uninsured. So for my plan, our plan, that's $2.8 million we spent last year helping to insure the uninsured. Any increase in that cost is unacceptable. While we definitely want the 180,000 other Oregonians covered, I would urge you to look at some other form of taxation, possibly on the payroll of employers who do not pay any medical at all. We've heard from employers today, small and large, who struggle to maintain health care for their employees. A small tax on the ones that don't pay any would certainly help out in this effort. If we were asked to make up a portion of that on top of that, we would do so, although not exuberantly. There are many employers with which the employer signed our contract. 360 employers in Oregon are signed to a contract, the United Brotherhood of Carpenters. Of that, about 80% employ less than 10 people. They are competing against employers that are doing projects right across the street that you would think are providing but are not providing insurance. They are undercutting us by 35 to 45%. This is putting an undue burden on our employers. We are in bargaining this year. We are facing freezes at the least, possibly rollbacks. Any increase in our health care is going to come off my members' paychecks. I would ask you to really take a strong look at that. Look at the people competing in this state who are not paying any at all. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Can I call Doug Davison and Dirk Mueller? and then three more at most after this panel.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. My name is Doug Davison, and I'm with a principal and a owner and a vice president of AKT Services. We employ about 200 people here in Salem, Oregon.
Thank you.
And we do provide health insurance. And I think with the look of the time at 8:15 and all, I'm just going to tell you my experience on what we're looking at this year and why we're looking at it and why I think I support the really more the broad-based tax and the really, I'd say, the premium tax. And that is simply the fact that our insurance costs this year are going to be about $1.5 million. And that's quite a substantial increase. And anything on top of that is obviously going to make the decision even more so. But as we look and think about it, one of the obligations we have as a CPA is simply to tell people, do what you can do legally to keep your costs at a minimum and pay the least amount of taxes you can pay under the law. And when I look at this proposal, if we go self-insured, it's going to lower our health premiums. It's that simple. And I think when you think about that, it's like, is that really fair that we can go self-insured as a, I don't know if we're considered a small or medium or size employer, but I'd say probably in the Salem area it'd be medium. We can reduce costs simply by going self-insured and avoiding this tax as proposed. Personally, although it'll help us, I don't think it's that fair for everybody. And my own thought on it is I would ask you to consider the alternative. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. I'm Dirk Moeller with Business Connections, and we're a small call center telephone answering service located right here in Salem, Oregon. We've been here since 1949, been providing continuous 24-hour service since then. My parents are the owners of the company. My brother and I kind of flip coins to who's coming here tonight.
You lost it.
And I appreciate all you guys being here. I mean, I know you're not making a ton of money doing what you're doing, but it's tough stuff, but it's necessary. We have about 28 employees. 23 of them are on the health plan because you have to work 30 hours a week or more. We started using Kaiser Permanente in 1988. I think the premium, I couldn't find it because I just found out about this meeting, but I think it was $68 when we started there per employee. Now it's up to about just under $250. We spend about $6,000 a month with a $20 copay. So this, if it's a 1.5% tax, it's going to cost us about $100 a month, a little less than that. I think both plans are flawed. All plans really are in somewhat, but I think the best one, if we had to pick one of the two, would be the claims tax. One thing I think everybody's thinking about is governmental entities always grab on and jump onto this. We'll get these Fed matching funds. That's a lot. When you look at it, that's a lot of money you're going to get up front, but this is a year in and year out thing, and I really think when the federal government's, they're going to start paying less down the road, and who's going to, then that 1.5% is going to start becoming 2.5%, 3%. Then eventually you're looking at some significant money. There's a lot of economic pain out there. I was on a 3-day vacation in Sun River this weekend. The old guy at the ski shop, he goes, I've been here since the 70s. It was actually a ghost town in Sun River. And he says, I've been here since the 70s. This is the worst it's ever been. My business is down. We should be really looking at job creation and not trying to aggravate employment. I'm afraid I might end up on this program later on, you know, if we keep doing stuff like this. So one other unfairness is I compete for employees at T-Mobile. When they came to town, the city of Salem said, hey, come to this enterprise zone or whatever. We'll give you free property taxes. And then Chemeketa came on and said, we'll help train your employees. So those guys were getting the free ride. They're going to get the free ride again, and then I'm going to have to, and I've always competed against them for employees, and I've taken a few of theirs, and they've taken a few of mine, and all that. So appreciate your time, and I would say go with the claim tax if you had to pick one.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Last panel, we have Tim Nickel. Joe Esmond and Jerry Hatch. Any of you have hung in this long? Three is not bad.
Representative Mona Anderson, or I mean Senator Mona Anderson, excuse me, Representative Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim Nickel. I'm the business manager of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 280. I'm here today to speak for the almost 15,000 hardworking union electrical workers in the state of Oregon, and I'll be extremely brief because I think everybody said it already, especially our partner in management, Tim Gauthier. We are opposed to this claims tax. That's it. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It's late.
Chairman Greenlick and Madam Chair Moines Anderson. I'm Terry Hatch. I represent National Electrical Contractors Association in Southern Oregon. I'm based in Eugene. We've got approximately 200 small businesses that I represent. Average number of people working there is about 15. We insure 1,800 families. These are small companies that are struggling to get by in the economy right now. And I wanted to bring some numbers to you to just give you a little sense of the numbers that we're talking about. Our current health care package is $7.45 per hour. It's about $1,200 a month. And that covers all members of the family, which is a great burden for the contractor to pick up. But it's really burdensome, and they are struggling daily to compete against other contractors that are not paying these kind of health insurance costs. Our costs have doubled since 2000. We were at about 3.5 an hour in 2000. We agree that there needs to be health coverage for all Oregonians, and from my perspective, this doesn't solve the problem. I think that these proposals are a Band-Aid on a cancer tumor. I'd like to encourage you to reconsider and look at something that's more broad-based. In addition, I also wanted to let you know that we've passed out a letter that came from Intel, it also represents the views of Intel, Nike, Columbia Sportswear, and Schnitzer Steel. Thank you very much.
Is that been distributed? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
The letter we have.
Yes, we are.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Would you indulge me and allow me to ask a question?
I would love it.
Thank you.
Make it easy, will you?
And I could have asked this of a few other people who testified also. I've heard some people come and testify in favor of a particular proposal. I thought I heard you two and several others testify in opposition, but I want to make sure whether I can interpret your opposition to one proposal as an endorsement of the other proposal.
For the record, Tim Nickel, through the chairs to Representative Nolan. No, I'm not endorsing the other one either. I feel that third leg of the stool, as Mr. Gauthier said, is missing here, and that's the people my contractors have to compete against.
Meaning we should mandate health insurance for everyone.
Well, Madam Chair, not necessarily, although I fully endorse that. I mean, the other option is just a small payroll tax that would apply to everyone. And it could be tiny.
The other witness.
Yeah. It sounds to me like that's also what you're
representing.
It would answer her question.
It's my opinion that it needs to be broader based, and I think a small payroll tax is much more acceptable to our employers. The fact is that they are paying the tab now, and they're being responsible about it, and they're breaking their backs. It's very expensive, and right now they just can't afford to bear any more. $7.45 is almost minimum wage in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your...
It would be about 7 cents an hour more to add to that. I hope you'd get something back from it. Representative Dunbar?
I'm sorry.
Are you done?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Well, I want to thank everybody that, particularly you all that came from so far away to help illuminate the very difficult decision we have, and we very much appreciate you being here. I think you saw how interested we were in your testimony. Senator?
Yes, again, thank you very much. I think that those people who are negotiating what's going to happen have taken these things to heart, and hopefully we will come to consensus.
Madam Chair. Just a brief comment. I just want to say thank you to all the employers who testified tonight and those who are listening for doing the right thing and covering your employees. Thank you.
Absolutely. All right.
All right.
With no further agenda, we are adjourned.
We are adjourned.
Committees, thank you.